بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين. Dear brothers and sisters, Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This session is the second session of our Khums discussions. First of all, I would like to thank you all for your du'as. Sorry for this delay. I was rather ill for a number of weeks, most probably because of the coronavirus. And sorry that there was such a long delay before we could start. It was a rather difficult period. And inshallah, we're back on track and we can progress. So this is the second session on Khums. In the first session, we covered the Holy Verse, chapter 8, verse number 41. To some degree and with some depth, we covered the verse and extrapolated a lot of information from it. One or two extra points that we can raise and mention in relation to the verse, I'll start off with those points. There were also a number of questions and people had sent through email, and we'll approach those questions at the end, although one of those questions I will answer at the beginning because it's in relation to the verse. There were one or two questions on history of the Khums. Those kind of questions, with your permission, I won't tackle at the moment because it's primarily focused on jurisprudence and fiqh and Islamic rulings. And there was one brother who sent a very long question. I want to thank them for the question, but I don't think we can approach that question. Maybe we can then, if he emails me, we can then enter into dialogue there. But I don't think it's very on a par with the nature of our discussions. Okay, so in relation to the verse, we then see that the Khums is for Allah and then for the Holy Messenger. And then it says, لِذِلْ قُرْبَى, which is the near of kin. And it has the lam preposition prefix to it. And therefore, the near of kin also is one of the owners of the Khums. They have ownership. And that's what the lam preposition indicates. Whereas the last three groups, which were categories of expenditure, where they would spend the Khums, they were not the owners of the Khums. The Khums is spent for them. And in relation to Dhil Ghurba, the near of kin, now this is, morphologically speaking, a singular term. But at the same time, it can be a collective noun. As well as being a common noun, it can also be seen, because the common noun, the common noun has a number of classifications, categories. One such category is the collective noun. So near of kin can include a whole variety of people. The near of kin are Sayyids in general. The near of kin of the Holy Messenger, they are Sayyid. And we defined what Sayyid means before. But here, the near of kin has a long preposition. And it's used, it's a common noun, it's used in the singular form. And therefore, when you see the verse speaking of the Khums being Allah's, Lillah, the messengers, Lirasul, here, this near of kin has to be on a par with Allah and the Holy Messenger. It can't just be any, so to speak, Tom, Dick and Harry. And therefore, the question of infallibility is a legitimate question here. Something which is the messenger's, if it's going to be someone else's too, that's someone else. when it's prefixed with a lam also shows that they have to be on a par with the context of the verse, which is in relation to Allah and the Holy Messenger. And therefore, we said that the Qurba, and we have traditions too, which speak of who the Dhil Qurba is and are over time. However, even if we didn't have those traditions, we believe that traditions of Ahlul Bayt are extrapolations of the Qur'an. So this is how we can extrapolate it from the Qur'an. The Qurba has to be an infallible, a ma'soom. But then we said, then we have three groups following and succeeding the Qurba, which is used in the singular form, but which also can be a collective noun that includes the ma'soom of the near of kin and the non-ma'soomeen of the near of kin. But here, dhil qurba, mentioned in the absolute sense, is prefixed with the lam preposition, but the following three categories of people are not, and therefore they are areas of expenditure, who you spend the khums for. They're not the owners. But with the dhil qurba expression, we can extrapolate that which follows dhil qurba are also near of kin, but the near of kin who are not owners of the khums. As I said, dhil qurba can be used as a collective noun. And therefore, the orphans, the needy, and the stranded travelers, those amongst the Sayyids, the khums can be spent on these three groups too. And from the verse and the structure of the verse, we can tell that these three have to be Sayyids also. Another point which helps us to understand from the Qur'an that these three have to be Sayyids and not non-Sayyids, even though, as we discussed in the first session, sometimes there's a lot left from when you spend for the Sayyids, these three groups, a lot will remain. Here, it's all the Imams, and the Imam has the right to spend it, even if it's for non-Sayyids. But another indication or proof that these three have to be Sayyids is because in the verse on the zakat and the sadaqat, we see that lillah isn't used. The rasul is used, but not lillah. And from this, it shows that the khums verse and the categories of the khums verse mentioned, the last three, are of a special or specific caliber, which does not pertain to the zakat verse. And we know that the zakat is not allowed to give. We're not allowed to give the zakat to Sayyids, although the exceptions also exist, but in general. And therefore, this special category also shows that these three, or indicates or alludes to, that these three have to be Sayyids, because the zakat, which is not for Sayyids, doesn't have the expression of lillah. And this shows a special importance or a specific importance in the verse of chapter 8, verse 41. Okay, now, there was one question emailed, or one part of a question that was emailed, and I'll just go through the question and answer it. The question was, the other questions, I'll come at the very end, inshallah. How can one be assured near of kin, the qurba, is not referring to your family members, your being mine, yours, normal people's family members? When discussing this verse with non-Muslims or Muslims of other denominations, many would deem near of kin as their own family members. Now, here, First of all, to answer this question, is that with the long preposition, prefixing ذِلْ قُرْبَى, it shows that ذِلْ قُرْبَى is an owner of the خُمْس, whereas our family members, they're not owners of the خُمْس. Our family members in general can only be the owners of the خُمْس if Allah has decreed it, and that's not the case. So my family members, your family members, the verse is not speaking about our, the common lay people's family members, because they are not the owners of خُمْس. The long preposition helps us in this regard. Furthermore, near of kin is used in the singular form. That's one buttressing point, and therefore has to be translated as such, whereas family members, it's not like that. Unless there's a contextual indicator implying that this singular form is plural. Because near of kin, in many verses of the Quran, is in relation to family members in the plural sense. Here, the context of the verse has to help us out. But ذِلْ قُرْبَى alone, as a family member, without the long preposition, it's problematic. It's okay with the long preposition, since it's the owner of خُمْس, it kind of dissuades us from this theory that it's referring to the family members, and also it's used in the plural. And also it's used on a par with Allah and Rasulullah. And this also buttresses this point, because the near of kin is used in conjunction to Allah, when it says Lillah, Lil-Rasul. And so here, those two are singular. This is used in conjunction with those two, and it's used on a par with those two to say that our family members who are sinners are used as one share, being owning the خُمْس, used on a par with Allah and the Messenger. That goes against the kind of spirit of the verse. We said they have to be ma'sum, they have to be infallible. Okay, so that was a number of points there that needed to be mentioned in relation to that question. Okay, there were a number of other questions we'll come to at the end, and I have something to say about one or two of them. Okay, now, the question after going through the verse, going through the definition of the خُمْس, the question is, upon what is the خُمْس levied? Okay, so what is the subject matter upon which the خُمْس is levied? This is an important question. The answer is three words, and we have to go through these three words explaining them. They're very simple words, but when we want to speak with the technical language of jurisprudence, these words have to be opened up and explained and properly dissected. The discussion of خُمْس is not a difficult discussion. Yes, it's expanded excessively throughout the years, and it's something which, because of the evolving of jobs and manners of earning, so many complex questions have arisen from the issue of خُمْس. And with the evolving of the times and technology and the advancement of all these different things, it has become a very important theme. It's like the Hajj, for example, which is so dependent on time and place and advancement of society and culture and civilization. You see that it suddenly expands with so many different rulings and emanations from different rulings that it can become difficult sometimes. Even now, sometimes when they ask me خُمْس questions, I may not be able to answer it. The many questions arise that can be quite difficult. However, the basic principles are relatively easy. you have to try and understand the basic principles. The more you understand the basic principles, then when you encounter a khums issue, you'll be able to answer it much more easier. Another thing which will aid you in answering khums questions is the more aware and informed and the more expertise you have in relation to different manners of earning. But if you're someone who doesn't have too much experience like me, then your expertise may be compromised to some degree. Anyway, I want to go through the basic principles. These basic principles are very important. And if there are any questions, any ambiguities, don't hesitate to ask, because if you don't understand the first two or three lectures with these basic principles mentioned, you're going to struggle. So please ask whatever question or hesitation or ambiguity you may encounter. The first question is, the subject matter of khums has to be a maal in Arabic, maalun. Now, maalun in Arabic, and its plural is amwal. In Arabic, I was searching for the translation for this, how to translate it. And the very commonly used translation is property. And I personally don't have a problem with the term property. So I may use the term property sometimes, and property, the person's property, doesn't have to mean a building, like some people may. Suddenly, from the word property, the expression property, the mind may wander, or towards the buildings and houses and so on and so forth. The estate agencies, they keep on speaking of properties and so on and so forth. However, after some deliberation, I've come up with a translation which I think it's more precise. And I want to explain why it's more precise. Because in Arabic, the spirit of the meaning of mal is the reality of that which, or it's that which one is inclined to. Something which you're inclined to, that thing, the process of inclination, the word is mail, but the thing to which you're inclined is mal. That's the spirit meaning. And here, when you're looking for a translation, the more the translation is on a par with the spirit meaning of the root word, the more safe you are. And here, we do have an English word. And that is belonging. Because a belonging is that which you have a longing for. Okay? And that's why I've chosen the term belonging rather than property. Because with a belonging, the duty bound has a longing for that thing. That thing is the belonging. Okay, so that's the first point. So it has to be a belonging. But if I use the term property interchangeably, you have to forgive me. That which you're inclined towards necessitates that thing, the belonging, has value. Because if it didn't have value, you wouldn't have longed for it. The fact you are longing for it, it means it has value for you. Now, when we say it has value for you or for me, we're speaking about the canonically abiding, the Sharia abiding, duty bound. Because he is the subject of the discussion. They want to give the khums. Okay, so this subject matter upon which the khums is levied for the canonically abiding duty bound has to be a mal, it has to be a belonging. Belongings have value. Value pertains to that of the duty bound, which in this case is sharia abiding. If it was to any individual, and someone may have a longing to sin, a longing towards a haram object or thing, that doesn't apply in our discussions, because here the subject is the sharia abiding duty bound. Haram things have no value for them, and so haram things will not be seen as a belonging in the fiqhi sense and will not qualify as the term mal. Okay, so whenever a possession now has value for a person, in this case the sharia abiding person, that thing is termed as a belonging, or in Arabic, mal. Now, just to give you an example here. Before I give the example, wine or a bottle of wine can either be bought from the supermarket, or it can be made with grapes by you inside your house. If it's bought from the supermarket, that would be a haram transaction. It would be a void transaction, and you would not be deemed, canonically speaking, as the possessor or owner of that bottle of wine, because the transaction is void. And when the transaction is void, it means you're not the owner of that. But the grapes was under your possession and ownership. Grapes are halal. Inside your house, you made a bottle of wine. Okay, now that bottle of wine, okay, is not a mal, but it's still under your possession. It's under your ownership. So see, there's a difference here on the roots of that wine. If it was from the supermarket, it's not yours. It's not a mal either for you. It's not a belonging, and it's not a possession of yours. But if it's made inside your own home with things like grapes, which were halal, and you made it, it's not a belonging, but it's still something, a possession of yours. It's still under your ownership. Okay? Now, so in this way, this is slide 4, the third line. In this way, a bottle of wine, if homemade, does not canonically qualify as a belonging, even though it is under one's possession. That's okay. I'm using this example so you can clearly differentiate between these terms. Now, in different countries, things like the outermost layer of a butterhead lettuce or dried up bread leftovers, for example, may or may not be deemed as a belonging. It all depends on that culture, on the people of that society. For example, in some countries, the dried leftovers are collected and are sold by the kilogram. Okay, so that may be a belonging. It may qualify as a belonging. Whereas in some countries, that's not the case. So I'm giving you the criterion. Whether it applies to your society or not, that depends on your society. So here, it may or may not be deemed as a belonging. These are just two examples. Or the outermost layer of lettuce is usually just thrown away. Okay? Now, whether it's right or not to throw it away, but it's now become common practice in some countries to throw it away, and therefore that has no value. One is not inclined to it. And therefore it won't be deemed a mal, a belonging. Even though there's a well-known story in relation to Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, where he stresses to his family members that don't throw the outermost layer of the lettuce away, give it to me, I will consume it. This statement is of utmost importance, and it shows Imam Khomeini's affinity towards the 12th Imam. Why? That will become evident as we enter other terms pertaining to the khums subject. Okay, now the final point in this slide is that when we speak of something being trespassed over or usurped, this concerns ownership, okay, not belonging. Now, I'll explain what I mean by that concise statement, and that is that something which is under your ownership, okay? If, let's say, someone comes and takes it from me, now that was under my ownership, it was one of my possessions, and they took it away from me without my consent, that would be an example of usurpation. They usurped it. Now, the part where I wrote not belonging, what I'm trying to show is that it doesn't matter whether that thing which was under your possession and was taken, it doesn't matter whether it qualifies as a belonging or not. The fact that it was under your possession is enough for usurpation. It doesn't have to be a belonging for usurpation to qualify. The fact that it was under your authority, under your ownership, irrespective of whether it was a dried leftover of bread, which for example has no value and therefore it doesn't qualify as a belonging, or not. So if someone has something of no value, which is not deemed as a belonging, but is under one's ownership, taken away from them, that would be an example of usurpation. You're not allowed to take it. So here is quite important for us to understand where these different terms, how they, kind of intertwine with one another. So, in short, if X thing qualifies as one's own possession, you're not allowed to usurp it, irrespective of whether it is a mal or not. Okay. In slide 5, we've just delineated the categories upon which the khums is levied. Now, so far, what is the subject matter upon which the khums is levied? It has to be a mal, it has to be a belonging. That's one of the three terms covered. Now, what's the second of the three terms? This belonging is of a particular type. What is that? We're going to discuss that now. This is just, slide 5 is a preliminary to that. Here, when you look at all the texts and the scriptural texts that we have, the Holy Quran and the Ahadith, one can deduct 7 classes of belongings upon which the khums is levied. And these 7, the first is the war booty. Now, there was one question sent on the Telegram channel, and it was answered rather weakly by those who had the audacity to answer them. And that's because the war booty, the question was that, is war booty a correct translation of Ghanimtum in the holy verse. And most people said, yes, war booty is a correct translation. But we said, if you remember in the first session, war booty is an application of that which you gain. Whatever you gain, Ma Ghanimtum applies to. The war booty is just one application. This root word of Ma Ghanimtum, the Ghain, Noon and Mim, that is means whatever you gain. Now, in some context, it's in relation to the war booty. It's used, though, with the same, the universal essential meaning, the spirit meaning of that which you gain, in relation to other applications too. So war booty isn't a translation. I think we explain this quite deeply, because something which I usually speak about in my lectures, because it's a key to understanding the Quran, that the words of the Quran, they're assigned a spirit meaning, not a tangible application of the spirit meaning. That's just one application. But that which is coined upon the word is coined upon a spirit meaning, an essence of a meaning. And here is that which you gain. Whatever is gained, the ghanama applies to it. Now, when you go through the traditions and the Holy Quran, we see there are seven things that have been deducted. The first is the war booty, treasures, you know, like, for example, the chests of treasures of kings which may be unfolded or excavated. Treasures or gains that one acquires through diving under the sea, I mean in the sea. Mining, extractions of different stones or, you know, gold, silver and other things, minerals. The land transferred from a Muslim to a non-Muslim under the protection of an Islamic government. Number six, any halal capital which is blended with haram, the khums is levied. And finally, number seven, one's annual gains, ma ghanimtum min shay, whatever it be. And then we have certain things which limit this general meaning. We'll come to all those. But one's annual gains, annual meaning, you know, after a year, whatever you've gained, after a year, the khums has is levied upon it. Now, why annual? These things we have to discuss later. Where do we get this annual aspect? When we say yearly or annual gains, from where do we derive that it has to be an annual process? These things we have to explain, and all of it we shall, inshallah. And the seventh class we're going to cover in detail. And if we have time, the sixth category, the halal capital blended with haram, inshallah, these two, they relate to, especially those living in the West, more than the other examples. Okay, now, we're still after the second of the three terms. The first was a belonging. But now, let's categorize this belonging. The classification of belongings, this is slide 6, which are under one's authority, not under one's ownership necessarily, but under one's authority. It's in one's hand, it's a belonging, it's in one's hand, but it may or may not be theirs. So, belongings which lie in one's hand and is under one's exploitation, it's under one's authority, can be divided into two. First, those that are canonically yours, i.e. you're the owner of it. It's your belonging, it's your property, such as your house, car, fridge, or phone. The second group are those that are not one's own belonging. They're not the owner of it. For example, sometimes property or things that have improperly entered your property, okay, out of an error or something happened, you made the wrong decision, but improperly, something which was someone else's is now yours, and now this has to be returned back, but you can't find the owner anymore. You don't know where to go. It's something, a belonging is in your hand. It's under your authority and exploitation, but it's not yours canonically. So this is the difference here. Radd madhalim is one such example that something has entered your property improperly, so it's not yours. You have to give it back. Or luqata is lost property found, and you've taken it, and it has criteria under what circumstances you can take something which you feel has been lost by its owner. And that lost property that has been taken, you found it, you've taken it, it's under your exploitation, and it's under your authority, but it's not yours. Okay, other examples, an incompetence property under your authority, or a minor's property, it's under your authority. It's not yours, but it's under your authority. These are just two or three examples. The point is, the subject matter upon which the khums is levied has to be your own belonging. And here, mamlukatun is the term in Arabic. So now we've gone through two out of the three terms. Malun, it's a belonging. Mamlukatun, it's your, it's under your ownership. You own it. It's canonically yours. And then we have a third, the third of the three terms. And inshallah, that we'll discuss in the next session. Okay, now, there were some questions posed. Now, since the organizers asked me to answer these questions, okay, I'll do so. But the point is, these questions, when I answer them, some of you may not be aware of the principles involved. And it's way too early for me to explain these right now. We're halfway through what the subject matter of khums is, and then I'm giving an answer which I'm presuming you know all the different preliminary points pertaining to the subject matter. So this can confuse some of you. I'm answering these questions with some hesitation. So even if you don't understand my answer, don't worry about it. You just focus on the lectures primarily and try to understand the main principles at hand. Okay. One question was, it's been almost 5 years I bought my kafan from Karbala. All of a sudden I remembered if the khums is wajib on that. Also, I am unable to know the price of it. Okay. Now here, you bought the kafan 5 years ago. Since you don't need the kafan right now, and you haven't used it over for a year, here we say such a thing which wasn't necessary, something which you didn't need and you didn't use, here it is not deemed as your basic expense. You didn't need it, and therefore it doesn't qualify as your basic expenses. But you spent money on it. Were you allowed? You didn't need it. Why did you purchase it? You can't purchase something to use in the future. Everything has to be spent in your year. And therefore, if you want to spend it in the future, the khums will be applied to it because it wasn't part of your basic expenses. Your basic expenses are deducted from what you gained during the year. But this wasn't a basic expense. This was not what they call a ma'una. It wasn't a ma'una. It wasn't part of your basic expenses. And therefore, you have to pay its khums. As you said, you remembered that later. Now, here, when you want to pay its khums of that kafan, you have to look at the current bazaar marketplace price. If you don't know what the price is in Iraq right now, see what the price is, an equivalent estimate in England, although it's going to be more expensive in England, but at least you're safe. You've paid your khums. So you have to see what the current bazaar price is. And then you pay its khums. Now khums means a fifth, okay? Whatever the current bazaar price is, a fifth of it you pay as khums. But there's a principle called the principle of one-fourth, or the principle of synchronicity, whereby if you this kafan that you want to pay, you have to give the khums of it, which is one-fifth of it, either you have to kind of cut a fifth of the material and give it to the religious authority as your khums, or what is more common is you have to pay a fifth of the khums, or fifth of the current bazaar price. But with what money do you want to pay this khums of the kafan? If the money with which you want to pay the khums of the kafan is not khumsated, i.e. the khums is still levied upon it and you haven't paid off that khums on that money with which you want to pay for the kafan, here you would have to pay a fourth of the current bazaar price. Why? Because you're paying the khums of the kafan with something other than the kafan, money, because you're not, you know, cutting a fifth of the kafan material to give it. If you did, that would be okay. Just cut a fifth of it, give it away. But you're giving the money. Now, the money is something other than the kafan. When you give the khums from something other from the subject, from the actual kafan, here, the khums to be calculated, if that money is non-khumsated, it's still, the khums still is levied upon it and you haven't given its khums, that from that of that money, you would have to give a fourth of the current price. Now, this is a principle. It needs one lecture for me to explain this principle. Okay, but if the money with which you want to pay for the khums of the kafan has already been khumsated, its khums has been given, or it's something upon which the khums was never levied upon in the first place, like inheritance, the money from inheritance, for example, here you have to pay one-fifth of the current bazaar price. Okay. Also, the same questioner, also there are many small tits and tats or bits, items I bought maybe 6 years or 4 years ago and haven't used them yet. Can I take out a round figure, khums, altogether for it? I don't know their prices. Yes, so you have to make an estimate of the bazaar price and then pay a fifth of it or a fourth of it as khums, as we explained before. And that estimate of the bazaar price has to be to a degree where you become certain, it becomes substantiated to you, that the duty of khums is now relieved. Now, note that sometimes those bits that you've bought, at the time you bought them, they were needed, okay, and it was on a par with your status. But you didn't use them. At the time you bought it, it was needed, but you didn't use it until your khums year, for a year. This khums year also has to be explained later. Here, there would be no khums levied upon that, what, the bit that you bought. The khums will not be levied because you needed it. The fact that you never used it, for example, you needed it because it was a rainy season. You bought an umbrella, but it never rained during the rainy season. that it doesn't matter. You bought it and you needed it, that umbrella. But let's say if it was in the month of June, which is the summer, and you bought an umbrella. Well, you didn't need an umbrella in summer because it doesn't rain. Well, unless you come from Manchester. But here, you didn't need the umbrella. And let's say it never rained during the summer season and you reached your year was in July, for example, 1 year after you bought the, 1 month after you bought the umbrella. It's your home state and you never used it. Here, the homes would be levied because at the time you bought the umbrella, you didn't need it. When you buy something which you don't need, it's not part of your basic expenses yet. It's like you're acting extravagantly. The homes will be levied upon it. Okay. And then there's another question which, from the same question apparently, but I didn't understand it at all. So they would have to rephrase that question. It says, I have 2 gold bars, which I might use it for others. Is khums wajib on that? And if I'm using it, should I take out the khums at current rate or the rate I bought for? I take out khums regularly in the month of December every year on my savings. But these things I just forgot. Yes, the question is very ambiguous for me. Okay. Now, another question. Regarding giving part of your khums directly to the classification of orphans, needy or stranded traveller, if the orphan organisation has an ijaza, a permission, will this suffice? Yes, I mean, but the permission has to be substantiated and for it to suffice. But if you follow Ayatollah Sistani, for example, since he allows you to give the khums pertaining to the last 3 groups of the orphans, the needy and the stranded travellers without the permission of the religious authority, you're allowed to go and give it. Here, nothing is stopping you. But it just has to be substantiated for you that it's a legitimate, you know, it's a legitimate organisation. If that's substantiated before you, even if your religious authority doesn't say anything about it or doesn't give the go-ahead, here you can give to the Sayyid orphans of that organisation. But you have to tell them this is khums money, they will know, and give it to the Sayyid orphans. Although for the non-Sayyid orphans, then it's used from other, from the zakat, for example, or even any leftovers from a surplus from over those 3 groups, the imam or the religious authority today during the occultation of the 12th imam has that right. How do you check the authenticity of the permission? For example, the orphan organization say we have permission from X manager. First of all, if you follow Ayatollah Sistani, that won't be necessary to get that permission from your manager. But how can you check the authenticity in general? But if you want to get the authenticity of the manager or from the religious authority, we have to go through the office or their representatives or any other means which you're sure that they have given the go-ahead. What if that ijtima, in brackets, I think, that is what the certificate is called, is given by a different manager to the one you follow. Can you still donate to the orphanage? Well, you can if you follow Ayatollah Sistani, because you're free from the permission of the religious authority in relation to the 3 groups, namely the orphans. But if you follow someone else, another manager who doesn't allow you to give the khums of the orphans without the permission of the religious authority, here you would have to, the question is, can it be given to you if your manager, your religious authority, does not give the permission for that organization, but another does? Can you do it? Well, the answer would be yes, if you know that your manager approves of that organization. But if another manager approves and you follow another manager, someone else, then you won't be allowed unless your own manager gives the green light. Okay. As I said, though, with Ayatollah Sistani, though, you don't need that permission. If it's substantiated before you, you can go. You don't need the permission from the manager, and you can give it to Sayyid Orphans. Okay. Okay, I think that ends the questions which were mentioned. As I say, there were one or two other questions too, but they were pertaining to different areas which we may not be able to cover or have time to cover in these sessions. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.